All right, Luke 24 is where we are picking up. And as we've been studying through the Gospel of Luke, it's been really great as we've been making our way through, but especially fun this year as, you know, the Easter passage was on Easter. And then now this kind of this technically the same Easter day here as we look at our text this morning. But we get the continuation because a lot of us, it's one thing to kind of talk about Easter and understand kind of like what is the point of Easter, but it's really the implications of Easter that are the reality for us today. It's more about, okay, so this happened, now what do we do? How do we respond? How then should we live, and what impact should this have in our lives? What does this demand of us as we are confronted with this information, with these facts, with these claims? And so Luke frames it up in, as we've been speaking of over the course of the last couple weeks, in these different witnesses, these different testimonies to the things that Jesus has said. He frames it up not just as a narrative explaining the moment by moment, the day by day of what happened, but he frames it up with these particular themes. And as we've made our way through these last couple sections and last couple chapters, what you'll see is that the emphasis is that it's been on this theme of witnesses. If you recall back, as we've discussed in the past, there is in the early books of the scriptures, the book of Deuteronomy, it's one of the first five books, and a particular collection of books that would have been specifically important to the Jewish people. And this is the law given to them by God about how they should live and the ways that they should weigh things and how they should interact with other cultures and societies and how they should order their society. But one of the things that we looked at was that when someone is making a claim or when there is a charge being brought, then you ought to have, it's not just enough to hear the voice of one person, right? Because someone could be making that up. But you need to have two to three witnesses that are the ones who are making this claim. It's by two or three witnesses that a claim is then established. And so what you'll find here is that throughout the book, as we've been studying, if you look back through our time together, you'll find that even just in the beginning of chapter 23, that there are groups of witnesses who share the status of Jesus. If you look back at 23, you have Jesus standing trial before Pilate. And he is there declared by Pilate to be innocent, having done nothing worthy of punishment. And then Pilate sends him. He doesn't want to deal with the situation. And so he sends him off to Herod. And Herod makes a similar claim. He's like, this guy, like, he's not worth my time. He's innocent. I'm going to just release him back. He gets sent back to Pilate. And so you've got these two witnesses, people who are who have no reason to think positively about Jesus. But yet they weigh his case and they say, he's innocent. There's nothing wrong with him. We looked at in the previous week that there is Jesus going to the cross, and he is hung up on the cross with these criminals. He's got a thief on his left and a thief on his right, and one of these men declares Jesus to having done nothing. He tells the other criminal who was hung up there with him, he's like, you and I, we've done something worthy of this punishment, but this man has done nothing. He makes this declaration about Jesus that nothing has, that he's not guilty. He's a completely innocent man. He's an innocent victim. And then after the death of Jesus, you find that there is a Roman soldier who makes this proclamation that he is innocent. You've got then, again, another set of witnesses, two witnesses there, who make this claim about Jesus's innocence. There's another group testifying to the things, to the truth of what Jesus said about himself. And then you find at the resurrection, This group of women, they go to the tomb and they are met by a pair of angels who testify to his resurrection. He is not here, but he has risen as he said he would. They reference what Jesus accomplished and what he already told them he would do. They're saying what he said can be counted on. It can be something that you can take to the bank, that it is sure, that it is faithful, that it is true. And then you have these women who go back and they make the claim that Jesus is gone. And Peter, he runs to the tomb and looks, and they both marvel. So you've got these different sets of witnesses. And now as we come to our text this morning, it is still the same day. It is still this Easter Sunday. And as they go throughout the narrative, you find another group of people crops up. These two men who are on their way to the village of Emmaus. Here's how Luke puts it for us in verse 13. That very day, two of them were going to a village named Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem, and they were talking with each other about all the things that had happened. So Luke, he introduces this other event that happens here. These guys are probably heading home to this village called Emmaus. It's not too far away from the general region of Jerusalem, and they're making their way back. And in verse 14, we're told that they are talking with each other about these things that have happened. Now, we kind of read that more loosely as they're talking about it, but as you look at the text here, where they're talking and discussing, these words kind of keep coming up here in verse 15, is that they're really more having a debate. They're really having a little bit of a, not an argument where they are opposing one another, but they're really trying to process out what has happened. They're trying to posit different viewpoints, like it could be this or it could be this, or here's what's going on with Jesus and here's what happened with him and here's why these things happened. And they're just kind of processing out, really for them, the trauma that they've just gone through for the last 3 days. And so they're talking about these things. They're engaged in this intense discussion. They're figuring out, like, what's really gone down. And in verse 15, we read this. While they were talking and discussing these things together, as they debate these things, Jesus himself drew near and went with them. But their eyes were kept from recognizing him. So a third traveler catches up with them, and Jesus apparently has this, he is in his resurrected body, and he is there, and they are specifically kept from recognizing him. Perhaps they think, like, hey, this guy's just another worshiper in Jerusalem. He's leaving to go back home just like us, but he's just a way faster walker than us, and he caught up to us, and now we're on the way, and so we're all going to kind of just journey together and have this conversation. But Luke makes it clear that these two men, they don't know who Jesus is. They don't recognize him. They know who he is, but they are not able to understand who he is. They're not able to see with their own eyes that here's what's going on. And this is key, right? Because it says they were kept from recognizing him. Okay, we're going to come back to that. They were kept from recognizing him. So Jesus shows up. He's with them. They're kept from recognizing him. And he wants to kind of draw out the conversation a little bit. He wants to kind of get to the bottom of what they're saying. And so he provokes them a little bit with this question in verse 17. He said to them, "What is this conversation that you're holding with each other as you walk?" And they stood still, looking sad. So their reaction here, they have a reaction to Jesus' question. Jesus, he's kind of sensing the tone. He senses the intensity of their debate. He senses how perhaps they are feeling here. And so they're like, what are you guys even like talking about? Like, why are you guys like so intense about this thing? Like, what's going on here? And I like how Luke describes it here. Like, they just completely stopped walking. They stood still, it says. They're just like, are you for real right now? Are you for real right now? They're walking and they just completely stop. And he tells us here that they stop and they are looking sad. It's like they are stopped in their tracks by having to relive this once more, to be like, oh my gosh, like this guy has no idea what's going on. And now we've got to delve back into what we've just experienced. We've got to revisit all of those events and those emotions. And we've got to explain this to him because he's got no idea what's going on. They're looking sad. They can't believe that anybody who would be on this same journey with them, who's just come out of Jerusalem as well, would have this perspective. Like, don't you know that there was just these crazy public events that just happened in the city over the last couple days? And so they're a little bit shocked. They're letting him say what he needs to say, but they're just, you know, beside themselves with the response. But nevertheless, they press in. In verse 18, then one of them, named Cleopas, answered him, "Are you the only visitor to Jerusalem who does not know the things that have happened there in these days?" And I love this. Jesus is like, "What things?" Verse 19, he said to them, "What things?" He's like, "What are you guys even talking about?" And they said to him, "Concerning Jesus of Nazareth, a man who was a prophet, mighty in deed and word before God and all the people." So they explain. Jesus draws this out of them a little bit. He's like, "Hey, what are you guys talking about? Like, tell me a little bit more. Explain to me what's going on. What are you guys really struggling with here?" And they begin to talk about Jesus. Now, they explain it this way. Well, there's a guy, Jesus of Nazareth. He was a prophet. He was very mighty in deed and word before God. He was clearly like a messenger here. And you can kind of sense a little bit of the hesitation as they explain this, because they kind of save their own perspective for last. Right, because they're in a situation where all of Jesus' followers, everyone's out to get Jesus' followers. Like, "Hey, do you really believe in him?" Right? Everyone's like the same thing that happened with Peter, where they're like, "Oh, you're with Jesus," and he's like, "Oh, no, I'm not." So they're kind of like tiptoeing around like how much information they really want to roll out until later. They kind of give him like the base level Jewish belief, like, "Yeah, everybody believes that he was just like a general, like, great prophet. You know, we think he's like doing some amazing things before God. And he had this really impressive ministry." But despite that, there's another side to the story, and they start to lean into this disappointment in verse 20. And they say, "And how our chief priests and rulers delivered him up to be condemned to death and crucified him. So he was rejected by the nation's leaders." These two men, these two travelers, they identify them as our chief priests and rulers. They own it. They're like, "These guys, they are our leadership, and they reject him. They don't want to be a part of him." And so they're associated with them, but they are also clearly indicating that these people, these religious leaders who were over the entire nation, they rejected Jesus. But then now they begin to share their own personal opinion in verse 21. "But we had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. Yes, and besides all this, it is now the third day since these things happened." So they start to roll it out, their own personal opinion now. "We didn't just think that he was just this prophet. Beyond that, our personal belief, our understanding was that we thought that he was going to redeem Israel. We thought that he was here to have victory. We thought that he was going to end up delivering the nation into a completely new era. And because he's now died, because it's the third day, our hope for that coming to fruition is now gone." Right? That's what they say. "And besides this, it's now the third day since these things happened." It's the end. 3 days have gone by. and no salvation. They continue on in verse 22. Moreover, some of our women of our company amazed us. They were at the tomb early in the morning, and when they did not find his body, they came back saying that they had even seen a vision of angels who said that he was alive. So they summarize, like, hey, the women were there. They came back in the morning. They said, like, hey, Jesus is alive. And, you know, it was like an amazing story. They went to the tomb, but they didn't find Jesus. They didn't. We were impressed by their report. Sounds like an amazing thing that happened, but they didn't find him. So, like, what happened to his body? Right? They're kind of having this discussion. It's the third day. We had this hope. It's not working out. But what's happening here is that Jesus is just letting it like linger out there, so we can see the complete irony in this situation. They're saying all hope is lost, and it's the third day, and there's no salvation, and we thought that he was going to be the one to deliver Israel, and all the whole time, it's precisely that it's the third day that hope is not lost. It's precisely that it's the third day that he is alive. It's precisely that it's the third day that he will redeem Israel. Their complaint is really the solution. The lack of the them not getting a report with where they see Jesus, where they see Jesus' body, is their biggest focus. They're distracted by this. They didn't find his body. They go on in verse 24. Some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but they did not see him. So they're laser focused on, like, seeing Jesus. The women's report, they didn't really get a great reaction. The disciples are like, okay, we're going to go check it out. They also didn't get a really strong response there. They go there. They didn't see him. And it seems like as they're saying this, they're like, okay, we want to see the presence of the risen Christ to confirm this for us. And as they are saying this, it's kind of meant to linger there because we already know what they do not. We already see from a different angle, from a perspective, we are aware of what's happening there. We can see at this new perspective that they do not yet have. So they're sharing this, and what does Jesus say? Look at verse 25. And he said to them, O foolish ones, and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets had spoken. So he comes straight out, not with like a, oh man, that sounds really hard. That sounds like really difficult. It sounds like you guys had a crazy last couple days. He doesn't come out with like this very specific, you know, like, oh, I'm going to coddle you guys. He comes out with a rebuke. He's like, you guys, I cannot even believe you. He responds with a rebuke. They were trying to tell him like how hard life is, what they're going through. And he responds by saying, O foolish ones and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. All Jesus is doing here is keeping in line with the same thing that the angels said to the women. The women go to the tomb, they're looking for Jesus, and what do the angels say? The women are there, they're frightened, they bow their faces to the ground, and the angels tell them, why do you seek the living among the dead? He's not here, but is risen. We read that as like a really nice thing, like, oh, you guys are so silly, right? Like the angels are just like straight up like facts, like why are you guys here? Like, he's not here. Like, you should not be here. This doesn't make any sense that you guys are here. Like, get out of here. There's no reason for you to be here. They're coming at him, like the angels are coming at him like pretty hard to like, they're not there to be like, oh, you know, like, I'm really sorry. I know you guys like schlepped all the spices and stuff to take care of Jesus. And I know you guys have been like really waiting in expectation since the Sabbath and you can't get here. They don't treat him like that at all. They come out and be like, what's wrong with you guys? How come you didn't listen? That's the response, which is so wild when you think about it. Because Jesus expects us to take his words seriously. He expects us to hear what he's saying and to be like, okay, yeah, that makes sense. He's so sure that he's going to keep his word that he expects us to bank on it, to promise, to put all of our effort and our hope into him keeping his word. He's not wanting us to kind of just be like, we'll see how it goes. It might happen, might not happen. If he says something, he wants us to go all in on it. And so they receive this rebuke here from Jesus. You're foolish, you're slow of heart. They don't believe the prophets. And basically the long and short of it is that Jesus is saying, look, like the prophets have spoken of this. For years, you have enough testimony of what has been said that the resurrection reality is not hidden from you. Jesus himself has spoken of it. The prophets have spoken of it. He emphasizes the Old Testament teaching regarding this. And he goes on to tease it out a little bit more in verse 26. And he says, was it not necessary that the Christ should suffer these things and enter into his glory? And so obviously within the ancient world, the consensus was, in first century Judaism at least, was that there would be this suffering servant, but that the suffering servant of Isaiah would not be the same as the promised Messiah. But Jesus says, the Old Testament prophets didn't have those same expectations. They clearly indicated that this was one individual. That you should know from the prophets that it was necessary for Jesus to suffer and to come into glory. And as he explains that, that's not just a resurrection, but that's also authority. He is raised not just to become alive again, but to rule and reign. He's been raised to life so that he might have victory over all things. Now, as he appears to them here, the fullness of his kingdom has not yet come, but it is enabled. And so they make their way. And as Jesus explains these things, he doesn't just bring them a rebuke. What does he do? He teaches them. He doesn't just say, like, you guys are a bunch of idiots. He doesn't even say that. He doesn't say, well, you guys should have known. And so, like, you really need to, like, just think about it again. He takes responsibility for their lack. They are not equipped. And so he's like, okay, well, I will empower you with what you need. Wherever they lack, he is there to make up for that, to provide everything that they need in their shortcoming. If they don't understand, he's there to teach them. He's there to meet every need. Jesus never demands that we do something or asks us to do something without also giving us the ability to do it, without empowering us to accomplish that, without enabling us to do what he's asked us to do. He always gives us exactly what we need. And so if he says that you should know this, you should know how the law and the prophets points to me, then he's going to then teach you about how that happens. And this is what goes on in verse 27. And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself. Best Bible study ever, I'm sure. He expands where he's connected to in every aspect, in every part of the scripture. All scripture points to Jesus, leads to him. And so they're hearing this. They're hearing this broken down. They're hearing how Jesus is connecting all of the dots and helping them see, like, oh, well, here's where it speaks of the Christ, and here's where it speaks of the Christ, and here's how this all works, and here's how it says he's going to suffer, and here's how it says he's going to enter into his glory. And he's connecting all of these things, and they are in the middle of this epic breakdown, and time is running short. Here's how Luke puts it in verse 28. So they drew near to the village to which they were going. And he acted as if they were going farther, if he were going farther. But they urged him strongly, saying, "Stay with us, for it's toward evening, and the day is now far spent." So he went in to stay with them. So they don't want Jesus to keep going. They're like, "Hey, like we're here. It doesn't make any sense for us to keep going past our village. We weren't going that far anyways. But it would, you know, maybe it'd be awesome if you just like, it's kind of getting late in the day. You don't want to keep going by yourself. Who knows how long it's going to be till you get to the next city. Why don't you just like hang out with us for a little bit longer?" They want to continue this teaching. They want this to continue to go on. And what does it say? They ask, "Stay with us, for it is toward evening, and the day is now far spent." So he went in to stay with them. Now, Luke doesn't have this in mind here, but I just think it's like a really cool little connection, a little fun connection here. Because the language that's used here, where Jesus says he went in to stay with them, it's pretty identical to the responding that happens in the book of Revelation. You know, in the book of Revelation, in chapter 3, there's a section where it says that Jesus says that I stand at the door and knock. He's like, he's there at our the door of our hearts saying like, "I want to know you. I want to know you. I want to be with you." And he's knocking. And if you open that door to him, if you say, "Hey, I'm interested in knowing about you. I'm interested in building a relationship with you." It says there that I will come in and eat with him and he with me. I will come in and be with you. And this is kind of exactly what happens here with Jesus. He's just kind of, he's caught these guys on the way and he's explaining to them who he is. And they're transfixed by the things that they're hearing. And he's just like, "All right, like, I'm glad you guys made it to your destination." And they're like, "Maybe you want to stay with us for a little bit?" And he's like, "Okay, I'd love to." Jesus is not interested in moving on to get away from you. He wants to be with us, but by invitation. He's not going to force himself upon you. He's not going to force himself upon anybody. This is by invitation. And so if you ask him for help, if you ask him for anything, I need to understand more of you. I need to be with you. I want to know more of you. If you open that door, if you ask him, if you give him that invitation, he will respond. He loves to respond to that. And so what happens here, verse 31, he was at table with them. So he does come in and eat with them, it seems. When he was at table with them, he took the bread and blessed and broke it and gave it to them. So they're together at the table. They're sharing this meal of fellowship. He's got the bread. They pray together. He's breaking it. He's dividing this up, giving it to them, and passing it along. So, you know, this is a regular kind of time of fellowship together. The most kind of like intimate part of the day where you would enjoy a meal together. This is, however, not a recreation of the Last Supper. This is not intended to be the marriage supper of the Lamb, right? Notice there's specifically no wine mentioned here, right? You don't find the same situation mentioned that is mentioned at the Last Supper. It is just to indicate that he's willing to be at the table, to spend time with these men. And so he breaks this bread, he gives it to them after praying. Verse 31, and their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he vanished from their sight. Like, epic verse. Everything changes here in this moment. Because they have all this debate and dialogue earlier before Jesus gets there about what happened to him. And in one instant, it's resolved. They realize who they're eating with. They realize all of a sudden, oh my gosh, this whole time, it's been Jesus. He's been with us this whole time. And then he's gone. Vanishes. He's revealing to them that he is alive. Okay? super key point here. His goal there in that moment was just to indicate, yeah, I am alive. That's it. That was the only goal. So as soon as he revealed that he was alive, he is gone. He's gone. And what do they say? Verse 32, did not our hearts burn within us while he talked to us on the road, while he opened to us the scriptures? When they didn't know who he was, and he was communicating to them the truth of the scriptures, they were on fire. They were like, this is epic. They were just like, that was everything that we wanted to understand how these things connect. And so, what they wanted earlier was they wanted to see Jesus. Like, oh, we want to, like, the women went to the tomb and he wasn't there. And they didn't see his body. And the disciples went and they didn't see his body. And I imagine that you and I are the same type of people, because we're like, it would be really great if we saw Jesus alive, like right now, and he just like showed up right now, and we were like, great. But as soon as Jesus gives them the glimpse of what they want, he doesn't stick around to entertain it any further. He doesn't stick around to be like, oh my gosh, you guys, like, yeah, it really is me, and explain what's happening, and like, I'm so glad that I could walk with you guys. No conversation about that, no camaraderie about that. Nothing about that at all. They get the realization that he really is there and that he really is alive. And as soon as they are aware of that, he's gone. So what's going on here? Well, if you recall, the rebuke for them happens specifically because they were looking for vision and they were acting in unbelief. They were acting in unbelief. They weren't banking on his word and his promises. They were banking on an experience. When Jesus already was trying to say, look, the testimony of what the prophets have spoken and what I said about myself is enough. After they say all their things, he rebukes them and he says, you guys aren't believing the truth of the prophets, of what they've been saying all along. And what does he then do? He doesn't say, look, here I am. He doesn't reveal himself to them there. Instead, he takes them to the source and says, look, I'm going to connect the dots for you. And they are convinced, they are encouraged by understanding how it all links together, how it was prophesied before about what would happen, and that Jesus does keep his word. And as soon as they are feeling that to the extent where they're like, we can't let this guy go because we want him to keep telling us, we're so hungry to know more of this story. They don't even know it's Jesus at that point. They're convinced by the scriptures and the testimony that God has already laid out for them. As soon as they don't need to see a glimpse of him anymore, then he's like, okay, here I am. And then gone. Because that was just to bring a little bit of closure to that particular instance and to connect the dots to another group. That vision there of him, to see him all of a sudden, was not to convince them that he just was alive. They already were convinced that he would keep his word by the time he made his way to the end of their time looking at the scriptures together. It's important for us to understand that, because that puts us in the same position where we can then look at it and be like, look, I don't need Jesus to show up because I know he's going to keep his word. He didn't deliver to them the vision that they were looking for, the sight that they were looking for. He delivered to them the connection, the truth of the scriptures, which still are the source of life for his church today. He doesn't call us to be like, well, you know, we're not in the first century and we're not in this situation and we're like looking for this physical appearance of Jesus. Like, yes, everybody would be pumped if Jesus showed up. Like, no, you know, it's not like we're not like, we don't need to see you, Jesus. We don't want you to be here. That's not what was being said. It's being said that we have enough and Jesus has given to us everything that we need already. These men have this reaction in verse 32 of hearing the truth of the scripture, of it being so strong, so connected, that they felt like it was their hearts were burning within them as Jesus spoke. They had this great comfort at hearing the scriptures open to them in this way. And then they hear the glimpse of Jesus, or they see the glimpse of Jesus. Jesus vanishes, and then we get this in verse 33. And they rose that same hour and returned to Jerusalem, and they found the 11 and those who were gathered together. So they're anxious to pass along the word. They're like, "Let's, we got to get out of here. We got to go tell them what's going on." They're ready to give their good news. But another report comes in before they have their chance. So the 11 are there, and these guys bust through the door, and they're like, oh my gosh, guys, guess what? And the 11 disciples interrupt these two travelers in verse 34, and they say, "The Lord has risen indeed and has appeared to Simon." So they're like, wait, what? Like, we were here to give like our cool report, and they get interrupted. They get interrupted by the disciples because Jesus has appeared to Simon Peter. It's like an incredibly fun situation, because not only does Jesus provide evidence for his resurrection on the road to Emmaus and with his followers there, but he also does it in Jerusalem. The excitement surrounding both of these things is so great that they end up interrupting each other. And from this, you get two things. Number one, that Jesus is going to give everybody exactly what they need in their locations when they need it. And number two, no matter where you are, Jesus is going to be at work. It wasn't that he was like, okay, well, you know, the travelers from Emmaus were like, oh man, like we really missed out on like a move of Jesus, you know, because like we left and we went to Emmaus, we went back home. And so like, man, we really missed out. That's not like a thing. The Spirit of God is at work constantly everywhere. It's whether you want to participate in what he's doing. Right, so there aren't like these like spots where it's like, oh, this is like the hot spot. Right, we always kind of talk about this, kind of breaking down the secular and sacred divide. Like, it doesn't make any sense that like this particular building is where like spiritual things happen. There's nothing special about it. There's nothing special about like this physical space. It's irrelevant, right? We could be like meeting, you know, in like a warehouse. We could be meeting, you know, in like a veterinary hospital. We could be meeting like anywhere. That's not what it's about. It's not the physical location that is what brings the spiritual nature together. The church is God's people, not God's building. It's a collection of people who belong to Jesus. It's not a particular physical building, a physical space. And so there's not spots. It doesn't make any sense to say like, okay, well, this is like a specific physical location where we all have to be. That's not to say that God is not moving with groups of people in different areas, and we testify to the fact that he is moving. That doesn't mean that he's not going to move in your area. That does not mean that he's not going to be working in your life and if in your particular region. He's more than capable to accomplish everything that he needs to accomplish in that region, in those particular locations, with whoever is available. There's no like FOMO for the Christian, right? You don't have to fear. There's no fear of missing out. That's not a thing. Because God will give you exactly what you need when you need it and the people that you need it with. You're not like, oh, well, everybody's going over here. Or, you know, maybe I should go with them. That's not what it is. You be as faithful as you can in the space that you're in with the people that God's put you with in that moment. And you live unto him. And he will accomplish his purposes. We're all one church, all one people, with all one Lord. And this is the case, as it's explained here in verse 34. What do the disciples say back to these men? The Lord has risen indeed and appeared to Simon. So earlier we see that it is Jesus who is risen, and the disciples call him out specifically as Lord. As we said earlier, as Jesus testified that he has been raised to glory. That means he is not just alive. And when he says he's Lord, that is that word that is used there to mean that he has a reigning and rulership. He is a king. He is in control. He has authority. So he's not just alive, he also has authority. And then we get the response in verse 35 from these two men. Then they told what happened on the road and how he was known to them in the breaking of the bread. So they exchange stories there of their accounts. Again, two sets of witnesses. You get the two witnesses come forward. You get these men on the road to Emmaus. You get Peter, and you get the disciples all together explaining what has happened. Jesus does what he says he's going to do. The testimony is sure and true. He himself has revealed himself to Simon Peter, to these men on the road to Emmaus. But more than that, he's explained to them that he promised he would do so. And he has shown them through his physical appearance that he's kept his word. We continue on in that trajectory as his people. We continue on believing the testimony of the saints that he has kept his word. Of generation upon generation has passed that along, and we live out the reality of the resurrection as we receive power, as we receive his comfort, as we feel the effects of the risen Savior even today. And so his church bears witness to his resurrection. Now, Jesus isn't done, because as he brings his testimony here, he continues to instruct his church and to lead his church, and that's kind of what we begin to look at in our passage next week and what continues in the book of Acts as we've studied before. But for us, we live with the reality of the resurrected Christ each day. That's why we're here. And so we operate as witnesses together again. And it goes back to that same moment where he was there with his disciples at the Last Supper, right? Asking them to bear witness to who he was. And so let's pray, and we'll respond together here in a moment doing just that. Lord, we are thankful for your word. We're thankful that you are at work in our lives. We're thankful that we can trust your word. And that you do the things that you say you're going to do. And we ask that you would help us to understand you more clearly, to know in our hearts and in our minds where you're coming from as you lead us. We don't want to come with our own expectations and our own assumptions about who you are and how you're working, but we want to let you show us. We want to listen to what you're saying. We want to respond to the things that you're saying to us. And so be at work in our hearts as we surrender to you, And help us to live for your glory and in such a way that we are bearing witness to the reality of your resurrection. And so be glorified as we respond together now. We love you. Amen.